All right. Well, it's good to be here. I think most of you know I lost my dad about 2.5 weeks ago, so it's been a rough couple of weeks here. But just wanted to say just one thank you for all of your kindness. Got a lot of flowers and cards, and one of the Sunday school classrooms like drew this thing for me that was so adorable. I thought, man, losing a parent is, it's a whole thing, right? I think it was Suzanne, Nancy's sister, was like, you get grief brain. And that's what I feel like. It's just my brain gets really tired and I get a lot of, I'm like missing details. So just give me a little extra grace these next few weeks. I think that could be a thing. And I wouldn't mention this, but I do think it's connected with the grief. You know, you get kind of stressed. So Wednesday I was carrying up this, it was like one of those big old microwaves that had broken, like one of those 25-year-old ones that are enormous, from the basement to carry it out to the trash. And I think I ripped a muscle in my neck. So it's hard for me to look this way. So I'm not trying to like exclude this side, but if I'm moving weird, that's why. Or if you hug me and I've got a little like icy hot eau de cologne, you know what that's about. I'm going to the doctor tomorrow, but I was like, man, just, you know, when it rains, it pours, right? Well, one of the things that I found that's apparently one of my coping mechanisms is I've been scouring ancestry.com. Rachel is a very patient woman. My dad had an early onset brain degenerative disease, so I have been intently going back through his line and reading the death certificates of everybody in that family line just to try and assure myself that I won't meet that same fate. I actually felt better doing this. I did not find a long line of it, but this will relate to the sermon. This is how I came across the obituary of my great-great-great-grandfather, Joseph C.H. Swan. And it was one of those things, if you use Ancestry and pay a little extra for all the, I was like, oh, there's like a lot of articles about this guy. This will be interesting. What's going on? He'd fought for the Union in the Civil War, which was kind of an interesting thing. He didn't have a lot of education, but as a farmer, he kept like really meticulous notes every day about the weather for 50 years in a diary. And then he came up with some kind of theory about the weather cycles repeating every 20 years, like clockwork. And so his obituary made me laugh, and I'm going to share a little bit of it with you. It's on the notes. Joseph C.H. Swan, famed in Kansas for his 20-year cycle weather theory, died in hospital on Monday. Poor old man! Exclamation point. What a struggle his life has been. No one has ever held to any theory more tenaciously or more honestly than did old man Swan to his theory that the seasons are ever repeating themselves in cycles. To him, it was more than a theory. It was fact. And then it says he wrote a book about it. The perpetual sorrow of his life was that so few people could be induced to believe in his quote-unquote discovery. Peace to the old man's ashes. The Marian Register. And there were quite a few articles along this line, and I just thought, whoa, he's the kind of guy who just is like, I'm going to dig in my heels on this one. I cannot be moved. And apparently, like, tried to evangelize everyone along this line, too. So we've been in this sermon series on Proverbs, and long before I read this obituary, I had been planning to talk about how the Proverbs caution us to be wary of this kind of certainty, and just wary of extremes in our thinking more generally. Right? Most of the verses just encourage us to be open to listening to differences, to being challenged in our thinking, adjusting views, because as sure as we feel about something, we might be wrong. So I think we're allowed to have really strong views about things, but we're just supposed to hold them with maybe a little dose of humility, which Joseph C.H. Swan may have lacked that dash of humility. Proverbs 18:2, fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. Proverbs 18:13, to answer before listening, that is folly and shame. Right? So we know this. It's unwise not to listen to others' viewpoints. Sometimes I think those viewpoints might even offend us, right? But if we close ourselves off from everything that we find offensive, we know we can be in danger of creating these bubbles where new information can't even enter. And we might not change our mind by, you know, talking with someone who differs from us on an issue. But the wisdom of the Proverbs just suggests to us that counter-arguments can help us hone our own perspectives, potentially change them. But it also helps us directly challenge ideas that we think are not life-giving, because bad ideas can fester in bubbles if they remain unchallenged. Proverbs 27:17, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. right? So it's this idea that we get to our wisest thoughts and decisions by hearing out multiple perspectives. And I think most of us know this, right? Especially if you like work in business or any kind of education system, if you frequently run meetings, you know that like when you pose a question to a group, the first person's answer tends to set the tone for the conversation, right? And then to bring out multiple perspectives, like you really have to usually ask the quiet ones and make it safe to have an opinion that might be completely counter to what's just been said, right? I hear what you're saying. I might see that a little bit differently. Obadiah, what do you think? Obadiah is my cat's name, so that's a, you know, and Obadiah might say, I agree, but Obadiah might also say, you know, I think you're missing something. And so the more perspectives, the more chance that we land on a direction that's beneficial. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. There's a story in the Bible, in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 14, that I want to look at this morning that I think can help us just think about this a little bit more. It's a story about a man called Jonathan, and I'm going to tell you that story here. It goes like this. Long time ago, in a land on the other side of the earth, there lived a man named Jonathan, and he was the son of a king, Israel's first king, Saul. So he was a prince, and he was heir to his father's throne. Well, Jonathan's people had been in a really long-standing war with some various neighboring groups. He was a soldier, his dad was a soldier, and often his dad would actually just lead the troops into battle himself. But as his dad was aging, he grew increasingly erratic and proud and angry, and he started to adopt some odd beliefs, and he seemed to not have people around him who were allowed to challenge those beliefs. And so one day, as the king was leading a troop of men, he told his soldiers, which did include his son, Jonathan, that they would be cursed if they ate food before evening. Right? So he said, I quote, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I've avenged myself on my enemies." Right? So none of the troops ate any food before this battle. And so as the army was marching that day, they entered into a forest. And as they looked, there were like honeycombs on the ground, right? And it said all the men saw the honey, and they noticed that it was just oozing out of these honeycombs. It was making their mouths water, but nobody dared to eat any of it, even though they were tired and they were famished, because they were worried about being cursed, and they were worried that the king would harm them, and he probably would have. Right? But Jonathan, who is the king's son, he had not heard that his father had made these soldiers promise that they wouldn't eat anything before nightfall. So as he walked along, said he reached out his walking stick and he picked up some of that honeycomb, picked it up, put it to his mouth, and he ate it. Now, I don't know if any of you guys have ever chewed honeycomb. It was so good. I was just talking about this with a couple of friends last night who did their PhDs at Indiana University down in Bloomington. And we used to go down to that region. I grew up in Indianapolis, and so we would like to go hike in Brown County State Park. It's this really cute little town down there called Nashville, Indiana, if any of you guys know it. Not Nashville, Tennessee, Nashville, Indiana. And as you get off I-65, you're going through this town to get there called Nawbone, Indiana. And there was always this rickety little shop in Nawbone that carried honeycomb. And so I would look forward to that every time we went down every year, and I would get a little thing of honeycomb to chew. And it's a little bit like, you know, like chewing something waxy that you spit out, but like the honey is so tasty, right? And so that's what I think of with this. I'm thinking, oh, it's so good. And it says, Jonathan raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. So we're just going to remember that. As he ate the honey, his eyes brightened. Right, so then one of the other soldiers said to Jonathan, they were like, dude, your dad bound the whole army with an oath to not be able to eat and said, cursed is anyone who eats food today. That's why, if you look around, all the men are faint. It says, Jonathan responded by saying, ah, my father has made trouble for the country. Do you see how my eyes brighten when I tasted a little bit of this honey? How much better would it have been today if the men had been able to eat? And then later that night, after they had fought this intense battle, all the men had finally had some dinner rations, King Saul decides to pray, and he asks God if he should lead the troops into another battle the next night. But the story says God did not answer King Saul. Right? So Saul becomes convinced that somebody has drawn a curse upon them and that God wasn't going to answer him because somebody did something wrong. So he calls together all of the leaders of the army to find out, right? He's got a little witch hunt going on here. Who cursed us by sinning against God? Right? And so King Saul told the leaders that once he found out who the culprit was, they would have to die, even if that's his own son. So of course, none of the leaders say anything, right? There's this like code of silence going on. Everybody's like, okay. So Saul says, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stand here with my son, and everybody else needs to stand over there. And so King Saul prayed again, and it says he tossed lots or drew lots. Basically, he flipped a coin. Right? He said, okay, heads, it's one of us, the problem. Tails, the problem's with one of you guys. Right? So it turns out it's with one of them. So he's like, okay, we're going to flip the coin again, and we're going to see if it's me or if it's my son, Jonathan. And of course, it reveals that it's Jonathan. I take this story as sort of like a literary device, right? Like building to the climax. I don't think this, like there was actually lots being drawn to lead here, right? So the story's building. We realize Jonathan is the one. Saul says to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. So Jonathan says, well, I taste a little bit of honey with the end of my staff, and apparently now I gotta die. And Saul says, well, may God deal with me. May it be ever so severely if you don't die, Jonathan. Right? And so I think the story here is revealing the extent of Saul's extreme thinking that has started here. And so at this point, the rest of the men, they go to bat for Jonathan, and they argue that he does not deserve to be put to death, and he was saved. Right? And I think this is just showing us the importance of being able to address bad ideas, standing behind like the one brave person who's standing there and naming this bad idea and its harms. And so you can imagine this story marked a turning point in Jonathan's relationship with his dad. So in the Bible, you know, honey is often used to symbolize wisdom, sometimes abundance, wisdom, sometimes both. This is very common symbolism in the scripture. See it in lots of places, right? If you remember the stories of John the Baptist in the desert, right? So he was eating like locusts and honey. And it's kind of showing his austerity, but it's also just showing like how wise he was. There's a couple of stories of prophets who symbolically, they say they eat scrolls that tasted like honey, right? This is Ezekiel and John the Apostle in the New Testament, like that the scrolls tasted like honey, this good wisdom, and then when they realized like what this wisdom actually meant, like made their stomachs hurt, right? So this is symbolism that the Proverbs is drawing on. Proverbs 24, 13 to 14. Eat honey, my child, for it is good. Honey from the comb is sweet to your taste. Know also that wisdom is like honey for you. And if you find it, there's a future hope for you, and your hope will not be cut off. All right, so we remember Jonathan ate the honey, and his eyes brightened, and he could see the way that he couldn't see before, right? This is like the moment when he changed his mind about his father, like this new filter he could see him through. And then it's only from that point onward he starts to really understand these problematic ways that his dad behaved. Right after he ate the honey, he said, my father has made trouble for this country. You know, it's that we probably all had those moments like, oh, he's the problem. Right? See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey, like the blinders got taken off and he could see what he had probably started to just normalize in his life. He could see his dad's volatility, the unreasonableness, his violence, his strange belief that his soldiers eating food would cause God to curse them. Proverbs 16:25. There's a way that appears to be right, but in the end it leads to death. Right, so Saul thought he was right in his thinking about this curse, but the consequences of this line of thinking were terrible. And I really think this is one of the most profound proverbs as I read through Proverbs, right? It's you better hold on to humility, it tells us, because there's a way that appears to be right, but in the end it leads to death. It's like, we could be that wrong about something. You know, like when I read this story, I relate to Jonathan, but I'm like, I could be Saul in some places, right? There's another proverb along these lines, Proverbs 4:27. Do not turn to the right or the left. Keep your foot from evil. I think that one's a little less clear in its meaning. But there's an interpretation that I read by Rabbi Dr. Shmuley Yankowitz. I love his name. And he interprets that verse like this. He says, with this verse, the book of Proverbs plainly encourages us to follow the middle path of moderation, avoid walking on paths towards extremes. This verse is an exhortation that is meant to dissuade us from embracing any kind of extremism as a manifestation of holiness. Meant to dissuade us from embracing any kind of extremism as a manifestation of holiness. Right, so in other words, in his interpretation of that verse, he says we need to be just especially aware of beliefs we hold that tell us that everybody who doesn't agree with us is unholy. Right, and so I think this story about Jonathan really illustrates this. King Saul adopted an extreme belief, a belief that told them anyone who didn't do what he told them to was impure and unholy, and they were going to pollute everyone else, and therefore were deserving of death. Right? So there's this like moralizing and punishment that went along with this extreme belief. And I do think essentially it's a wariness of purity cultures, that story is. Right? And I think purity cultures can manifest across the spectrum on both the right and the left. And I think they say, if you disagree, you're a bad person. You're hurting us all, you need to go. And I think Proverbs says, be careful if you find yourself thinking that way. You might be playing with fire. So extreme beliefs can, on occasion, be correct, right? But I think wisdom just tells us, just be wary, that we need to stay open to the views of people who feel differently than we do, embrace humility in regards to their views, not default to describing moral judgment or punishment to people who disagree with us, be willing to change if that's where the information leads, because something that we believe with all our hearts might not turn out to be life-giving. Proverbs 15:30. Whoever heeds life-giving correction will be at home among the wise. Whoever heeds life-giving correction will be at home among the wise. There's even a caution about eating too much honey, right? About having too much wisdom in terms of extremes, and how mistaking your own wisdom-seeking can be more about being how great you think you are. Proverbs 25:27, it's not good to eat too much honey, so to seek one's own glory is not glory. Right? So it's telling us we can even take seeking wisdom to an extreme, or spirituality maybe to an extreme, and that stream is probably more about patting our own selves on the backs. So I think the bottom line is just like, be cautious of extremes. It might not be wrong, but just be very, very wary. In the case of my great-great-grandpa, Joseph Swan, I think speaking with extreme certainty was not a matter of life or death, but it's a little caution that speaking with a lack of humility can actually leave an enduring legacy. One that his great-great-great-granddaughter dug up and preached about. He may have been a perfectly nice guy. Who knows? All right. We usually take a little time here of silence or guided meditation. I mean, whatever you want to bring before God in this time is fine. I did offer up a proverb, but I would suggest if you'd like to just maybe hold this before God and consider it. And that's, whoever heeds life-giving correction will be at home among the wise. And just like maybe see what the Spirit is saying in that space. People make noise. I'll let us know when this time is up. Whoever heeds life-giving correction will be at home among the wise. Holy Spirit, I ask that you would just always help me to be teachable, help us to be teachable. I know many of us have already changed our minds about big things in our lives, and I ask that we would experience the blessings of that kind of sort of adaptability and keep our hearts soft and continue to help us on the path toward wisdom. Amen.